This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If we've learned one thing about rapid climate change, it's this. We don't know how it will unfold. Will it be drought or flood or alternating years of each? As just happened in Texas, they had record wetness in 2010 and now record drought and heat in 2011. Or what if the problem is expressed as seasonal instability, like the summer weather now in the UK, causing flowers to bloom at the wrong time? There are sunbathers on the beaches of Britain on the 1st of October with temperatures in the 80s. It's crazy stuff. We don't know how the insects, the plants, the diseases will shift, and we don't really know what to prepare for because we don't know what's coming. So let's return to our guest, biologist and systems thinker Alderstone Fuller. In our last session, Alderstone said climate change is upon us and probably cannot be stopped. We briefly discussed how to handle that personally and emotionally. Then, looking at what we should do, what is the difference between adaptation and adaptability?
Adaptation is preparation for a change that is relatively constant. That is, if climate were going to change from one relatively stable state like it's been for the last 10,000 years, we call this temperate climate, if it were going to change from one stable state to another stable state like the last 10,000 years, then we could adapt to that. If it was going to become consistently, let's say, hot and wet, we could adapt to that. The problem is we don't know exactly what state we're going to be in. It'll be extremely variable and chaotic. And so we can't adapt to that. So Domanowski prefers the word adaptability. She says that our ancestors, our hominid ancestors that survived the ice ages, the brutal, extreme, chaotic ice ages, did so not by adaptation, but by being adaptable. That is, They could roll with the punches. They could survive in one environment, and then when things change rapidly again, they could survive in that as well. So she emphasizes that we need to increase our adaptability, not to plan for adaptation, but to increase our adaptability. And again, that's what she's referring to by shock-proofing our basic human needs, water and food and shelter and energy needs. We've got to be able to grow food in hot and dry conditions, hot, wet conditions, cool, wet, and cool, dry. You've got to cover all your bases. And an adaptation strategy that plans for hot and dry is not going to make it in cool and wet.
Well, you mentioned that you're something of a person who likes to move around, a bit of a nomad. I'm wondering whether, if the climate changes as rapidly as you and as James Lovelock have suggested, many of us are going to have to be nomads and move from where we are because we can't live where we are.
I fully agree. It's part of my, well, I guess I'm semi-nomadic by nature. I have been since I was in my 20s. I just have enjoyed living in various places in the country. But I think it predisposes me to the type of lifestyle that people in the mid-century may want to really consider. I can't imagine right now putting down roots in Central Texas after the summer that they've had, 40 consecutive days above 100 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
And it's still going. In Waco, Texas, over the weekend, I think they were still in the 100 degrees. So I think it's going to be a reasonable strategy to consider by mid-century, if not before, to be able to pick up and move, which means, of course, that we need to considerably lighten our load. We don't want to be moving. Everybody moving your belongings in a big moving van, an 18-wheeler, is probably not practical. So lightening our load, living more lightly.
And I wonder, too, whether the agricultural-type answers that people are putting forward, you know, we'll plant our soil right where we are, but maybe the climate won't let you grow anything right where you are if it changes. So that leads me to ask you how you would compare the adaptability project to the transition movement.
I'm going to do sort of an A and B thing here. Good question about the Transition Town project, because I'm involved in one at the current time, and I really value their approach. I want to say just one word, if I can, before I forget, about agriculture. In my opinion, we need to shift from what we've been calling agriculture, especially monocropping, and especially industrial agriculture, which was problematic in the first place anyway. We need to switch from those approaches to more of a permaculture approach. Now, I know just enough about permaculture to be able to speak about it in broad general terms. I'm not at all an expert. I know a number of people who are, but I think definitely permaculture is the way to go for meeting food needs, perhaps other forms as well, but I think permaculture should probably be the focus. Now, set that aside and come back to your question about the transition town movement. As you probably know, and your listeners may know as well, it was founded by a person named Rob Hopkins in Great Britain, predominantly around the question of peak oil, petro collapse, if you will, the fact that we're running out of readily available liquid fossil fuels, oil. A fair amount of coal left, but our economy, especially transportation, is not based on coal, it's based on oil. So they've realized for some time that when we hit that peak oil, when oil is no longer readily available, it's going to change everything, including our ability to grow food, because we use oil in tractors for fertilizers and pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. So they have built this idea of transition towns around the concept of peak oil. How do we redesign our communities so that we can live in a post-oil world? And I think their ideas are wonderful as far as they go, but as far as I can tell from studying Rob's book, his handbook on transition town, which I recommended for reading, and reading their website and essays and such, it looks like to me that they're still having the mindset of we're also preparing for type 1 climate change. They don't use the word, the terms type 1 and type 2, but from what it looks like, they're preparing for type 1. There's no indication that they really get it in terms of type 2 climate change, rapid, abrupt, extreme. So if I could do one thing for the transition town movement, it would be to bring in my view of type 2 climate change based in system sciences and geophysiology or Gaia theory.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Alder Stone Fuller. And you've mentioned the influence on your work of Sir James Lovelock, but you must be aware that Gaia theory has its critics. We've had Professor Peter Ward on Radio EcoShock. His book, The Medea Hypothesis, was suggested by the National Academy of Science. Ward says Earth is not a friendly place run by living systems, but more of an out-of-control experiment, and judging by the geological record of near extinctions, Ward says life overall seems rather suicidal. Have you read Ward's work, and how would you answer that criticism?
I have not read Dr. Ward's work. His book is on my reading list, which is unfortunately pretty long. I have read reviews of it, and in reality, I think that he and Lovelock are not necessarily as far apart as Dr. Ward thinks that they are. Lovelock and his colleague Lynn Margulis, down at University of Massachusetts Amherst, with whom, by the way, I spent 3 weeks in her lab a year ago last August, studying with her. Dr. Margulis and Dr. Lovelock co-developed the Gaia hypothesis, now Gaia theory, in the 1970s. Neither of them portray Gaia, at least in Lovelock's later writings, neither of them portray Gaia is some benevolent goddess that is a consortium of sentient beings somehow regulating the temperature and chemical composition of the atmosphere. It's not a town meeting of species. That's not the way that Gaia works. The way that I explain Gaia is this. Imagine your own, you, Alex, your own metabolism and homeostasis. Metabolism is just simply the sum total of the thousands of kinds of chemical reactions that are going on inside of every one of your cells. It's the basis of your life. That's metabolism. Homeostasis is a set of processes, respiratory processes, cardiac, blood sugar controls, your nervous system, your hormone controls, your urinary system, all of which maintain the proper conditions of temperature and chemistry for your body. That's homeostasis. Gaia is simply homeostasis and metabolism at a planetary scale. It is the sum total of all the biogeochemical cycles and the natural homeostatic processes that operate at a planetary scale. Just like your homeostasis is not under your conscious control. It happens automatically even when you sleep. Gaia's homeostasis is the same way. there's not a conscious intention. The species are not collaborating to set temperature at whatever degree, at whatever level they wish. It's not the way it works. Gaia is not a sentient entity. It's an automatic homeostatic process. And they, Lovelock and Margulis, also realized that at certain times, Gaia can be brutal, more like Dr. Ward's Medea. Gaia is not benevolent, but can be pretty mean at times. And our species, our ancestors during the Ice Ages, experienced that meanness. And, of course, I'm speaking anthropomorphically there. Again, not mean in a conscious way, but sort of metaphorically.
And I want to ask, then, can civilization survive climate change?
It can, but not in its current form. I'm one of those, like Lovelock, that thinks, yeah, our human numbers are probably going to be severely reduced by the end of the century, or sometime around the end of the century. I mean, there's too many unknowns to be able to say exactly when or by how many, but I think the numbers are going to be reduced, and civilization as we know it probably will not continue. Civilization in some form, meaning being civil to each other, large cities like New York and Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, maybe not, but some form of civil society, hopefully based in permaculture as opposed to industrial agriculture. But I tend to think that our species is pretty wily and pretty intelligent. I think that we will figure it out. It's going to take some work. You know, it's going to take a lot of challenging times, but I think that we can survive and hopefully follow Dumanowski's recommendation and completely remake what civilization is on a much smaller scale, much more sustainable scale.
Well, as we wrap this up, I'm hoping you're going to just give us a brief talk about the Gaia 101 seminar you offer, how people can participate in that, and how they can get a taste of your work.
Thanks for asking that, Alex. If I can, I'll repeat my website again. It's www.alderstone3.com. And if you look at the top menu on the homepage, you'll see Gaia 101 take you to a set of pages that describes my new seminar. Now, I call it a new seminar. These are actually ideas that I've been teaching for almost a decade, at least some of them for almost a decade, others for only 5 years, but they're strung together, linked together in different ways now, in a new way. Gaia 101 is a seminar that's going to be both a live seminar, that is, I'll be there in person doing it, but it's also going to have an online component. The live seminar is roughly a 10-hour seminar, that is 10 hours of lectures with lots of Q&A, question and answer, and discussion. And it could be done either on a long weekend, sort of as an intensive, say start on Friday evening and run through Sunday afternoon, or I can stretch it out over about 3 weeks. Online, it'll be about the same length, but people can join it as they wish. There's no regularly scheduled meeting times. They can simply download the seminar, study it, and ask me questions either online or by email or even by telephone. And there's three parts to Gaia 101. Briefly, they are, part one is an introduction to system sciences, ideas like system states, system attractor states, tipping points or critical thresholds, positive and negative feedback, the theory of emergence. All of that is necessary principles to understand Gaia, which is part two, and it's an introduction to Gaia theory and geophysiology, the science of studying Gaia. And then part three is about type 2 climate change, rapid, extreme, abrupt climate change. It's simply impossible to understand type 2 climate change outside of a context of system sciences and geophysiology. It's just impossible.
So we've all got a lot more to learn, and you're offering one way to approach it. And we have to run now, I'm sorry, but to find out more about Alder Stone, try out the website alderstone3.com. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Download this interview and all our past programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Thank you, Alder.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Some background music by Vast Mandana at soundclick.com. Our economy collage created by Kaput Radio, Australia. Thank you so much for listening. and stay tuned next week. Diane Dumanoski, The End of the Long Summer.
Chapter 9, Honest Hope. The way through the world is more difficult to find than a way beyond it. Wallace Stevens. In times of danger, bitter truths serve us better than sweet lies. The modern era has not taken us where our guiding myth promised. The belief in deliverance through progress has been shattered by developments such as the ozone hole and global warming. Our most rapid progress now may be toward making the planet uninhabitable for many kinds of life, including ourselves. The decades ahead promise unimaginable loss. Much of the world as we know it, the maple forest of the New England autumn, the coral reefs and tropical waters, the polar bears and countless other plants and animals, low-lying islands and sandy beaches, and perhaps even some of the world's coastal cities, will likely vanish in the lifetime of a child born today. These are not the dark prophecies of environmental apocalypse invoked to scare us into changing our ways, but simply inescapable consequences of the change already set in motion. Shutting off all greenhouse gases today will not stop the warming any more than shutting off the engine can stop a runaway train hurtling down a mountain, though it might switch us onto a less precipitous and calamitous track. The century ahead promises to be a wild trip.
In just a moment, you'll hear from the Automatic Earth. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock on Progressive Talk Green 960, San Francisco.
Organizers of the Occupy Wall Street protest are angry at government bank bailouts. Scuffles in New York between the police and demonstrators calling themselves Occupy Wall Street appeared on YouTube as activists tweeted that dozens of people had been arrested. The group is using social media to call for peaceful protests against what they describe as corporate greed in America.
There's no way to avoid the ongoing disaster in world banking circles. Our next guest says we should pay attention because politicians and bankers are selling off our future. We may have no money to pay for mass transit, solar conversion, or any project to save ourselves from peak oil or climate change. We'll go now to a man whose blog rings true for millions of people. Writing as Ilargi, our guest dives into the latest banking fantasies, looking for reality. From the Automatic Earth, Ilargi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be here.
Well, I wanted our listeners to hear you, Ilargi, because even though you're a financial writer and Radio EcoShock is mainly environmental, you wrote that people concerned with the environment should watch these financial bailouts carefully. Why do you say that?
Specifically because I think that maybe people who focus on the environment right now are missing out on the financial crisis, which is much more urgent, which is a much shorter time frame. And by missing out on that, they risk getting us into a situation where their children, for whom they wish to preserve the environment, will have no choice but to destroy it, because they will have nothing left. You can imagine a situation in which people burn every last tree simply because they're cold. We tend to think more from a situation of luxury.
And you don't think that luxury is going to continue?
Not the way we're going now.
Well, getting to that trigger point for the European crisis that everybody writes about, we know that Greece entered the European Union fraudulently. Goldman Sachs helped Greece to hide those mountains of debt in some shadow banking system. Do you think that Goldman Sachs undermined the European Union?
In that sense, yeah. I would rather put it in more broad strokes, though. I don't think that focusing too much on Greece is all that healthy. Because Greece is not the problem, and Greece is just the first part of the problem that shows up. What I read a lot these days, ever since the Greek crisis really started being prominent, is that if only we would do that, or if only we would do that, and it's the fault of the politicians who don't take the right measures. And you have a lot of that kind of comment, and I think it's all bogus. I think the entire situation is completely, there's no solution for it.
Well, I'm reading that in your blog. You seem to be getting sort of fed up and almost wishing the whole thing would blow up. It might be better for us. Is that how you feel?
Well, that sounds very negative, Alex. I think, and I've written this repeatedly, what has to happen is all the assets held in bank vaults have to be marked to market. There's far too much stuff in bank vaults that nobody has put any valuation on. And so there's a lot of stuff that's in their vaults for 100 cents on the dollar and it's only worth 10 cents on the dollar. And it's time that we recognize the real financial situation of the banks. Because, you know, what a lot of the politicians say these days with all this bailout money is that it's to restore the confidence in the market. But how are you going to restore confidence in the market if the markets know that there's still a lot of paper, trillions of dollars worth of paper in bank vaults that everybody refused to put, let's say, a true valuation on?
What if these banks actually come clean and it turns out they're totally bankrupt? Then what do we do?
Then they have to go bankrupt.
But our money's in there.
And what we should do as societies is ring fence is a popular word, ring fence the deposits of the people rather than saving the banks. The story we are fed is not true. You know, the story we are fed is that we have to save the banks because that's the way we will save ourselves. But if the banks are too deep in debt, that's not going to work, is it?
And the same goes for countries.
The idea is that if $1 trillion of public money doesn't work, make it five, and that should work. But so far we haven't proven that, have we? So maybe it's time for a different tack.
There are a lot of connections and risks for Americans. Can you talk about that?
The fact that the Americans like so much to talk about this as a European issue is, first of all, to take attention away from their own problems. I was just reading an article today, I think it was in The Guardian, about underwater mortgages in the States. Well, who's talking about underwater mortgages these days? Not a lot of people, because everybody likes to talk about Greece, right? I think the U.S. itself is in very, very deep shit. And maybe Greece is a little bit worse, but it can't be that much. Plus, Greece is a lot smaller than the U.S. But there's also a lot of banking connections. Morgan Stanley came under fire at the end of last week, and that is primarily because it has a lot of ties to French banks, which have a lot of ties to Greek banks, which have a lot of ties to the Greek government, because everybody, both the Greek banks and the French banks all own a lot of Greek sovereign debt. And then Morgan Stanley has a lot of links to the French banks. And one thing that is hardly mentioned these days is derivatives. And apparently Morgan Stanley still has a $56 trillion derivative portfolio, if I remember well. And of course, Morgan Stanley is very closely connected to all the other banks on Wall Street, and it's a simple story, really.
And we are talking with Ilargi, and his blog with Stone Lay at theautomaticearth.com is one of the most popular financial blogs on the net.
It's still .blogspot.com. It'll soon be .com.
Okay, .blogspot.com. Let's get back again.
We will. That's good.
Our guest has been the financial blogger Ilargi, a constant contributor to the blog The Automatic Earth. A new entry comes out several times a week. I read them all. You should, too. Ilargi, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
I like, because he tried to frighten us.
Yeah, he was scary.
He did the political equivalent of holding a torch under your chin. and he said that this was the economic equivalent of wartime, which I presume is just bluster. If it's genuinely that bad, yeah, that's the sort of stuff we should have.
I'm willing to give my pants for parachutes.